Yes, well, it's about 10 years since we started the forest genomics program with a much waited for call from the NSF saying, go make us a physical map. And so it seemed like a really good time to start talking about what was discovered in that process as we try and justify to you, the community, and to them, the NSF, now under new management, why forest should be amongst the soybean genomes resequenced. As most of you know, the soybean genome has been sequenced by DOE, and it will be, the annotation will be released, the first public annotation will be released in April. And the question becomes, what next? If we're to follow the yeast model, then we will continue to sequence in related genomes so we can triangulate gene function. Clearly, tropical legume has already been done in no tropical legume has been done. Medicago and lotus have been done. But my argument is going to be that because soybean is a crop and because crop breeders use variation within cultivars, it's going to be important to triangulate gene function within species, and that forest is an ideal vehicle for that because forest is as different from the Williams 82 sequence as anything grown in the United States. Not as different from Williams as anything grown as a cultivated soybean, but nonetheless important. It's from an isolated germplasm pool, the southern germplasm pool, which is different from the northern germplasm pool in many ways. And that shows up in the genome and genome comparisons. But I realize that most of you are not soybean scientists, nor want to be. What you want to know is, what can we do for you? And so what we can do for you is give you a lead for solutions that you will need for studying your genomes if they be polyploid in nature. Because you see, soybean has gone through two rounds of polyploidization, one ancient, one kind of recent, and that more recent polyploidization event has not completely decayed. We still therefore see multiple alleles for our RFLP markers, and indeed even multiple alleles for our microsatellite markers in different populations. The other tropical legume, which would be nice to triangulate with Glycine Max, is Phaseolus. Anything from the Phaseolus genus would be wonderful, because it didn't undergo the second polyploidization event. There are recent polyploidization events in many other species, including Medicago, which complicates things when we try to compare it with Glycine Max, that and the fact that this is a tropical legume and this is not, just a temperate legume. There are polyploidization events in living human history, like the strawberry. Wild strawberry, the size of my fingernail, is diploid, the one that grows in my gum. And there was a polyploidization event in Europe and another one in Japan in the last 200 years, which took it from the size of my fingernail to the big succulent fruit you now buy at the supermarket. So it is important. Polyploidization event across many crops seems to be associated with agronomic potential improvement, indeed, making the plant a crop. In soybean, there is evidence that the two polyploidization events were different. One was an autotetraploidy, one was an allotetraploidy, and Scott Jackson's lab has more or less shown that the centromere-associated repeats are still different in two sets of 10 of the 20 chromosomes. So that's what we have. And then, of course, the genome was scrambled between what was linked with those centromeres, so it no longer makes any sense at all whatsoever, hence those dotted lines were blue. You can see the evidence for the polyploidization events in the Ka to Ks ratio ESTs, and this is a slide from Wolf's lab in Ireland, and there's a semantic argument about whether it was 4 or 15 million years ago and 14 or 40 million years ago. But that's probably esoteric at this point, enough to say that it happened, and but that it has not yet decayed. So what we can see by looking at the pattern of conservation of polyploidy in soybean is that if every gene went from a single copy state in that hypothesized ancient diploid answer to a tetraploid state and then onto an octoploid state, the decay from there has been significant. 35% of all genes have gone back to a diploid state in the soybean. There's one example of them, however low you set your blast ratio. About 10% of the genome has conserved itself in a tetraploid state, and about 20% of the genome has maintained the octoploid state, giving you 100%. It is interesting for cultivar for scientists working on individual cultivars to speculate that individual cultivars are still undergoing these deletions. In other words, if you've got four copies of a gene all doing the same thing, you can delete one of them and generate new variation within the cultivar. But that's proved particularly hard to get a handle on. Anyway, so as I said, this was a review. So here listed are the key breakthroughs in forest genomics, forest cultivar of the soybean. And the first one really was the Mexome Baclibris, published back in 2000. That led directly to the cloning of a number of genes, the first one being RPG1B by Ashfield and Roger Innes, then at Indiana. The physical map, the first physical map, and the one that caused all the trouble, because it was preliminary, was published in 2004 and had some problems with it, which I'll detail in a minute, caused by that polyploidy. Quickly followed by a second publication describing a third back library that supplemented the physical map. 2005 saw the release of the population, the mapping population that stands behind your ability to use FOREST. In other words, you can follow segregating genes in RILs, but also more importantly in NILs that are derived from each RIL. And all of this led to identification of candidate genes underlying SDS resistance genes and then a SCN resistance gene down here, and the release of a whole bunch of satellite markers to take the actual available set for soybean from 1,000 that the previous speaker talked about to 2,000 that we enjoy today. Okay, so physical mapping as done in soybean was not all that different from the physical mapping you might be doing today in your crop of interest. It was a sequencing gel based system. It used Indy3 and He3, so it got you about half as much data as, say, a high information content fingerprinting would today. But it was pretty well subject to the same advantages and limitations as the HICF method, using slightly less data. The whole thing, the output of all of the physical maps, is shown through GBrowse, both Build 3, the Wu-based build, and Build 4, the Schultz-based build, are available to you. And basically, GBrowse just gives you a very good way to view everything from contigs to clones to loci to QTL, all at once, so you can get positional information about your locus of interest. So a little about what went wrong. Because of the polyploidy, in conserved polyploidy in the soybean genome, we made a lot of bad mergers in Build 3. The problem was we'd get two contigs, each anchored with the same marker, which encouraged us to merge them, creating bad mergers comprising multiple parts of the genome. And this might seem iterative, but I'm still reviewing papers from others who do this. Three this year. You can see evidence for polyploidy in your contigs from overexposure of your markers, if you choose to do this. You can see that a microsatellite marker here, SAT305, has multiple amplicons, and indeed you might think that those are just erroneous initiation, but no, if you choose to go ahead and map those different amplicons, you can place them on different linkage groups. So these truly are genetic markers, genetic homeologues of microsatellite markers. Thanks to our ability to publish almost anything in the supplement of a paper, we've published a complete catalogue of every satellite marker in soybeans, relationship with every other linkage group, as predicted from anchoring to the physical map. So you get this sort of spider pattern, and it's a 20 by 20 array, meaning you've got 400 different associations. Almost impossible to publish or make sense of in any other sense than when you have a marker close to a QTL, you have to go look and see where your homeologues are. We can take out some genes of interest for us, the SCN resistance genes, and find that we have two genes on A2 and G, and those locations bearing the SCN resistance genes have relationships with other linkage groups. So here's some of the data that we have that diploidization in soybean has been incomplete. If we take 202 probes for different gene families and hybridize them to the BACs and determine how many gene family members there are per probe, we find 35% of our probes only identify one BAC. 25% identify two members. So this would be diploidized, this would be tetraploid. Relatively few with three members, but a higher proportion than you would have predicted for linear decay for four members. So these are the octoploids. And then, of course, it goes off from there. So we can use probe hybridization of the minimum tile to generate the same sort of information that we get from these other sequence genomes. It would be interesting to see how this holds up during the annotation of the sequence scaffolds. The other way that you can see evidence of polyploidy in your genome based on a physical map is to count the bands, the number of BACs that cover a unique band in the physical map Conti. And if you do that, you'll find that if you have polyploidy, you'll have evidence for structure where some unique bands are coated by a layer of exceeding 20 BACs, others exceeding 12, others exceeding 6. In our case, where we went to six-fold redundancy, that's an indicator of ploidy also. So bringing all that together allowed us to make a physical map that made sense, the so-called build 4. And in build 4, we recognized that when we had two contigs with good Q values that supported that the contigs be separated into separate units, but both anchoring with the same microsatellite marker, we had to recognize they were different and not dump them together. They're actually two different regions of two different chromosomes, but we don't know which one's right. We don't know which one actually goes on linkage group A2 and which one goes off on some of the linkage groups. So we use boats on a lake and we show them both there. The idea being that the user's going to come along and be informed to be careful. So that physical map then is apportioned into diploid contigs, polyploid contigs, total contigs, polyploid contigs, and unique contigs. And you can identify them quickly by looking at the soybean genome database by what number the contig is. If it's a 9,000 series, 9,000 and up, it's an octoploid contig. In other words, there's a bunch of them in the genome, eight, well, actually four since we only ever show a haploid genome. The 8,000 series will be tetraploid, predicted to be tetraploid in nature. Once again, this is markers and bands per unit clone, BACs per unit clone. And anything below 3,500, I think, is likely a diploidized contig, as far as we're concerned. Okay. So that has allowed us, in this era where we have the sequence scaffolds from soybean to compare with our physical map, to generate build 5. In build 5, we take our good contigs and use the marker anchors and all the back-end sequence data that we have from these contigs and blat searching to figure out which contigs line up with which scaffolds. And that's really very exciting. We supplement that with reverse marker anchoring. We take microsatellite markers that we find in the back-end sequence from the contigs and put them back onto the genetic map, and that helps as a second test external verification system of marker locations. So here's just one example. This is a back-end sequence taken from clone B16A10, which can be mapped back in Essex and Forest. There's a polymorphism, Pyramid and Douglas, and Minsoy, and I'm afraid Noir got cropped off there. But anyway. Currently at SoyGD, you are able to view not scaffolds. That will not be possible until next April, but you can view traces. So anywhere a trace file matches with a back-end sequence, we give you evidence for that here. Clicking on it will give you the name and allow you to go to GenBank to retrieve the sequence. In some recent work that Navinder Saini and I have been engaged in, we've been comparing back-end sequences with the trace database, not the scaffolds, and so we can show you that. And if you just go to the MegaBlast trace file depository for soybean at GenBank, and inquire with a single backend sequence from Forest, you'll get this sort of picture. Some of the clones across some of the regions are absolutely homologous. These are the regions that are identical between Forest and Williams. Other clones with a certain degree of homology will align with that clone. So these are the homeologs, if you like. And you can cluster those homeologs according to their, what we're calling SNHs, single nucleotide homeolog polymorphisms, SNHPs, I guess would be better for it. So you can see the GCT here distinguishes four different homeologs. The T occurs again here, a couple of G's, T, C, and so on. So it is possible to see these homeologs either that way or using the tree build function that's also available through GenBank. Then you can cluster the ones that are close, and you can also see the ones that are not. Trace files have validated what we did with separation of the contigs, because when we take backend sequences from the diploidized contigs, like contig 321 here, we see differences. We see regions where there's absolutely no differences, and then regions where absolutely everything is different. And what these are SNPs between Williams 82, where the trace files come from, and Forest. Sometimes that can be quite extensive, and sometimes that can be a single nucleotide. Here we have another example from a diploidized region where there's actually three clusters. And you'd be hard-pressed to tell me which one of these Williams contig clusters, homeolog clusters, is the exact locational paralog of the Forest, and which is different. Once again. So overall prediction from the whole thing is, although we have 25% of the genome in octoploid regions, because of the additional power of resolution of sequence, we're only going to be talking about 1.9 to 2.3% of the genome where sequencing can't tell the tetraploid and octoploid regions apart. So that's good news, right? Final thought is that as we align the backend sequence from contigs with the sequence scaffolds from soybean, we can start to see things that make Forest and Williams different. Although it's possible to march clones across regions of scaffolds that encompass the soybean genome, there are regions where that breaks down. So, for example, soy B72TH only has a match on one end of the clone, not on the other. And the other end of the clone is sequenced. It just doesn't match anything currently in the scaffold sequence database. Now that proves to be exceptionally difficult to prove that it's there in Forest and not in Williams, because Forest backend sequence never marches the whole way through a repeat, or very rarely. And of course, the sequence scaffolds in Williams have only been made from 4KB clones cloned in PUC 18, so not everything's there. Okay, so in summary, we've used rigor in how we develop our contigs and an annotation scheme to separate tetraploid from octoploid contigs to generate a set of sensible contigs. That set of sensible contigs could not be anchored to the genetic map without sequence scaffolds, but with sequence scaffolds, it has proven possible to generate a smaller number of contigs, which we will be able to release at the same time as the sequence is released. So the sequence helped the physical map, and of course the physical map helps the sequence by identifying regions where there are problems. So you need both. Recent attention has turned to syntony analyses, and we went first out to Arabidopsis thaliana, and you can see this one in BMC Genomics. And more recent publications in this area include the latest description of the browser in 2006, the minimum tiling path paper 2006, locating the gene probe families 2006, the syntony map 2007, the backend sequence microsatellite placement in physical maps 2007, and a poster on how we use it to chase down a protein and oil QTL with association mapping 2008. Last word is, do read this one from 2003. If you're looking at any physical map, it gives you the trick to find out if the physical map is good or not. It's hidden in a journal called Genome Letters, but it allows you to determine whether the contig you're looking at is garbage or good. It's a simple trick that's not been published anywhere else. Okay, so conclusions. We are ready for genome sequencing by nanotechnologies because of all the resources we have and a physical map in two cultivars and already a genome sequence in the first. Since we're short of time, I'll leave it at that and let you read the slide. Any questions? Yes. This is forest backends to Williams scaffolds generated by Dr. Munch, Schmutz rather, at DOE. So was this. This was to the trace files. So that was scaffolds, this was trace files. That was trace files, that was trace files. So only at that point did we do scaffolding. We've done more, we're not allowed to talk about it until later.